bank called, we call the Asian Infrastructure Development Bank. You just Google it and see the new bank launched by China. Paul, are you, I mean, you might know. Asian Infrastructure. Yeah, somebody Google it, whether it's faster.
Sorry, Chip, which paragraph is this?
The paragraph could be about what you observe in the class. You see the sequence here. Just add a few things that you're having a
Shepherd, and I think it does add up to two, could be wrong. Chairperson, I think we did take the schedule straight from Treasury, and I think it does add up to 2 billion.
It does.
The only thing that I was going to mention relates to the FSC's proposals, but I don't really think the budget office actually needs to comment on those. I think national treasuries indicated that they will take up any concerns they have and so on. So beyond that, I don't think we have much to add.
I think the Honourable Ross is provoking us. Some of us were victims of structural adjustment program in Zimbabwe, you know.
Coming out from their own studies. So it's not even about our teenagers, those who have been affected by some of these programs, you know. So, I mean, Honorable Ross should just be rest assured that it's their own acceptance, that they were not developmental, they were not consultative, you know. So it's not like we are imposing something new.
Well, thank you, Chair. The Honorable Committee Whip has actually taken the words out of my mouth. That indeed we must sitting right behind you. That indeed it is precisely because of the shortcomings of these institutions that we've had to establish our own bank. And that needs to be noted in the report. Thank you.
Yeah, you know, I'm looking at this, right? I can't resist saying this. But actually, it's very, very mild, right? Look, it even says something like, the committee understands the various complexities and challenges, right? It sort of covers it, right? But the truth is, it's extremely mild by the standards of the government. And the government's more, let's say, careful, right? Parliament is not bound by those same sensitivities. And it's very mild, actually. It really is. And the truth is, as Ben said, mandate imposed, and look at the consequences, right? And in fact, where countries have succeeded often is despite the World Bank's intervention, many of us have argued. So look, I don't want to debate the thing. It's an ideological difference. Here you have every right to raise these issues, and you are protected. But at the same time, there are times when you can be tactical and say, okay, if I raise this now, it's going to open the floodgates, and we're going to die from it. So... I mean, now you're a nice guy. Now you're setting a bad tone. You're becoming more like George. I'm teasing you. So now that George is gone, David's becoming more like George. Okay, so he's never the good cop. He's the bad cop. No, no, he's not David. No, we expected you to say that. At least think that, not say it. Let's be more precise. But here we are. This is before us. I would like us to just mull over it and then vote on it tomorrow. It makes no difference. We hopefully will go for the debate on the 10th. Okay. Colleagues, comrades, we hand over to Momo and his team on the Twin Peaks regulatory reform. Before I do that, let me just announce some progress issues. One is, we're hoping to have SA next week, right? Cindy? Yeah. Yeah. Tuesday or Wednesday. SAA. Yeah, we want to just look at their turnaround plan, program, how far it's gone, etc. And their various proposals on going forward and their quarterly performance. There must be the board chairperson coming, or if the board chairperson is completely out, then they have a deputy chair. Or a senior board representative, but we must have the board representative. You can't just have a CEO. We won't accept only a CEO. So it has to be the board chair. But given the notice is short, and if she's not available, then a deputy chair or a senior board member, because it's a board that accounts to Parliament, not the CEO. Even if the CEO does most of the presentation. Then there were outstanding issues. Oh, yes. On the issue of the MEC's office, I did raise it last week with the DG. There's no need to take it to the minister. I mean, it does seem as if we can settle there. There seems to be a lot of misunderstanding, but they've agreed to meet to sort out the office and move. Well, I don't know when, but the both sides agree that the issue should be settled. So maybe Cindy will also come back and let us know within a month what's happening in that regard, or before the end of the summer. Then the issue that's outstanding, colleagues, is the state-owned entity's input from the PBO. That, too, we want to do. If we can, whatever the SAA, can we sort the SAA out this afternoon? Then if it's a Tuesday, then the Wednesday, we should try to do the SOE. Or the other way around. Okay. Now, I just wanted to ask you, when I see in the program for tomorrow, there is the rates and monetary bill. What is that now? Just what happens there?
what usually happens? Oh, right. There's nothing for us to do. So we don't debate, it's just the minister that speaks to them. So there's no rule that allows for declaration. Then the other thing, members, we have to... Sorry, you want to say something?
Yes, sir. Chair, I don't know if I'm out of order here, but in the Chief Goods Forum, there was an agreement. Sorry. There was an agreement that parties would be allowed to make declarations. Yes.
Okay. Okay.
Thank you.
Any other questions? No, I plan to actually attend to some other matter, personal matter. You don't need to know anything. We're over. You fled from all those things as soon as I had. So you have no case. Right, now, colleagues, so now we must also plan for the study tour. I think you'll be delighted to know. We're going to visit the Customs and Excise Division. So, that's the first week of the third, and theirs will be pleased to know. Because theirs is our child man. So, we grew him there, right? To deploy him. He doesn't know it yet. And I have no power to deploy him, but I'm creating the space to groom him. Only for if you end up ambassador to Mongolia, but that's how we work, right? So now, sorry? Okay, well, it's raining and it's cold, man. You know, I'm going to keep going 21 years later. How I hate, let me tell you, how I hate this combination of cold and rain. I think it's uncivilized, Tandy. I think you must excise Western Cape, Paula. I know you're from here. You know, every time, Paula Esso is so distracted, right? I'm going to report to her boss that she's not here to promote to what's happening. All you Cape Town people should be apologizing to us. That we have to suffer this. Alinda, sorry, your sister, yeah. Whom I know, by the way. Okay, over to whoever from National Treasury.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for giving us this opportunity to talk to Twin Peaks. Aside from that, we love to actually do it. So we actually, our only complaint is you don't call us often enough. Chair, I've got Catherine Gibson and Kershaw Singh with me. Roy asked to be excused,
Are these two young people ready for this committee? I can't control this committee. You know, I've been here 21 years. Now, they were in their nappies when I came to Parliament. You think they can control that? Forget that. David Ross is the most amenable, nice guy. It's the ANC caucus, I can't control. You think these two are going to be able to be married?
Absolutely.
And who they know we're going to sit here till 4 in the morning?
She's quite a veteran here. She's done financial. Catherine has done quite
a few. Oh, we haven't seen her face before.
Yeah.
Okay, fine. So you're ready, eh? How old is your baby? Oh, no. Then you are chuffing. Then you can take the
So, Chair, what we're going to do today, is just to let you know where we are, because we've talked about Twin Peaks the next month. And also the term, first I heard of it was when there was a TV series on it.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, just it's just good to remind ourselves and get a perspective. Obviously, you had the 2008 global financial crisis, and there's no doubt that brought a paradigm change. Okay? We could say in 2008 that we were ahead of the curve, our financial sector survived pretty well, but we didn't take that for granted. And in fact, we started under two ministers before Trevor Manuel. It was close to, in fact, a few months before the Lehman crisis, you had the Jali panel inquiry into bank charges. And you also had one Mr. J. Arthur Brown who first hit the news. And it was around 2007, and Minister Manuel actually set up a committee to assess some of the weaknesses in our regulatory system. So we started them, and obviously the financial crisis came and took over, and we had to expand our work. And we produced our response in 2011 with the so-called Red Book that we published. And Chair, I would still recommend that book to members. It's I still think quite relevant in how it set things out. And it kind of did set out, I think, a little show that this was our response as South Africa. We were saying, one, we cannot be complacent. This is a dynamic sector, and it's not the world of the dynamic. Use that which outlined the shift towards student fees. Of course, subsequently we had African Bank, but I'm saying this is now years before we're saying we can't be complacent. We then produced a roadmap in 2013 just to outline how we would move towards student fees. We produced the first draft of the bill in December 2013, which we came to speak to you about, I think last year, November, and then in December, we got the second draft of the bill. But with the bill, we also published a document called a response document to just take into account comments that we received. For example, the issue of licensing had come up. We talked about it, about our approach. And we produced this book called Treating Customers Fairly in the Financial Sector, a Draft Market Conduct Framework for South Africa. And in fact, today we want to spend time on this particular aspect of twin peaks, because we always talk of the prudential side. The reason why we're not going to over-focus on the bill is because we'll be tabling it shortly in your photocopied notes were said in June 2015, but I just asked him to say it's July 2015, because the bill is already been looked at, part of it by the state law advisors. There's lots of people working on it to finalize it so that it can be introduced in Parliament or tabled in Parliament. Yes, yes. We've got approval to table. In fact, Cabinet got, I think, fed up of us taking it to Cabinet all the time. So that's where the bill is, and we were given approval to table it, and that's what we intend to do. And we hope, inshallah, that by April or so next year, we can actually start establishing the two authorities. Because I think we did say that we didn't have to be a leader. We should wait and see what the rest of the world was doing, because they were in trouble, they had to move, and that we could respond as we saw how they moved. So of course in America you had the Dodd-Frank legislation, and in, certainly in the UK they implemented twin peaks, and you'll see that our twin peaks and the UK's one is very similar. Okay, let me say we didn't copy them either. We actually, I think our document may have preceded theirs by a month or two before they then announced how they were going to move. But given the situation they were in, they had to move much faster to implement. What we'll outline is just that the twin peaks is going to be take us a few years. Certainly the first phase comes to the end once we table the legislation and establish the new regulators. But in parallel, we're working towards the second phase, which is to begin to finalize the conduct framework and to produce a bill which we call COFFEE, which I'll come to in a moment. So just to make some, just to remind us, I think the point we made was when we looked at our regulatory system, we noticed that there were just too many regulators involved with the financial sector. Now, we also agree that you can't have one regulator. In fact, Trevor Manuel, in his second term or so, tried to set up, interestingly, there was very little regulation of the financial sector until the 1990s. What was it, the NELC, the commission in 1991, forget the name, which set up the FSB. So, and in fact, in the early 2000s, many financial intermediaries were not even registered. Anyone and or their dog could give you financial advice. So you had all those acts set up in the early 2000s, like the FICE Act. But most of these regulators, let me say, were prudential regulators. And I'll come to explain it in much more detail. The National Credit Regulator certainly was an exception in that it was a market conduct regulator. And of course, today the situation is most institutions, you can take any bank, any major bank in South Africa, you'll find that it's regulated by the staff, the Banking Supervision Department. It's regulated by the FSB because they do insurance or they do asset management. It's regulated, they're all regulated by the FIC, all the bits of the bank, because there's very tough anti-money laundering and funding of terrorism provisions. And of course, if they lend, they're also regulated by the National Credit Regulator. I won't talk about the health inspectors for the building and so on. I mean, that's normal. This is over what's there, okay? And currently, the approach is that each activity intended to have its own law. So there's a Banks Act, there's a Short-Term Insurance Act, a Long-Term Insurance Act, and that's why Honorable Ross will say, but where do you find ShareMax or property syndicates? Because when you define an activity, of course, the financial sector is like water. It moves between the gaps, and you have, that's where you have the problems. And I think the third point is really important. You know, the dirty secret from the financial crisis globally is that though regulators all say they cooperate, they have beautiful MOUs, but to be honest, what in the UK, for example, they looked at, they weren't worth the paper they were written on, because the crisis happened, okay? And that's not to say that when you regulate the sector, you will never have a banking failure or so. No, you're going to have failures. And you mustn't try and design a system so it's so safe that nothing happens. In fact, it's so safe that nothing will happen. So, you know, if you do nothing, it's extremely safe. But I don't think we would want that, because you would really have a recession, or you'd have very low or no economic growth. So the whole issue of coordination, Chair, I would like to ask this committee and others to really look at that carefully. You know, it shouldn't be a word. Like, I often think in government, when you use words like integrated, developmental, joint, sometimes we just have to put a name because we actually do the opposite, okay? So when people say they coordinate, honestly, they don't, okay? And you really need to cast very strong lights what the quality of that coordination is. And of course, the more regulators you have people who follow shop. The regulators look for the weakest link, okay? And this is not a South African problem only. It's a worldwide problem. And in fact, one of the big issues from the financial crisis. So you had the Bank of England, you had the financial FSA, the Financial Supervisory Authority. They had beautiful MOUs, the FSA in fact moved towards a unified model. We saw REFCO also almost moved to, but I think Governor Mulvaney at the time stopped Minister Manuel from implementing it, but in a way, thank God he did that, because the FSA model kind of really didn't work, okay? And the UK then abandoned that approach of a unified regulator. And it's not to say that any one way is the right way. Any of these methods, approaches could work, but I think, honourable members, the one thing to know about regulators is there's a concept called home host regulators. Okay. So it may surprise you, but if you're EBSA Bank or Barclays Africa, your home regulator is not the SARB. Okay. It is the Bank of England. And the Bank of England will also focus on the FCA, which is the other twin, will also regulate you. The South African regulator is called a host regulator. Now, we protect ourselves by insisting that our major banks are subsidiaries and they are listed. So there's a form of ring fencing. So the host is relatively more powerful. But ultimately, the home regulators are quite important, and in fact, after the financial crisis, you have what's called supervisory colleges, where the regulators of the home and all the so-called host countries come together. So if you look at Barclays, every country where it is, there'll be a host regulator. In South Africa, in parts of Africa where they operate, in the US, wherever you have the brand, the Barclays Bank. And I think that's an important point to just understand. Now I'm going to not really spend too much time on these other slides because I think we've talked a lot on Prudential, but just to remind you, and I think you saw this with African Bank, that most banks are not, it's not just one simple banking company. There's a holding company, there's all kinds of subsidiaries. As you saw with African Bank, we can't move on the hold, we can't have a curatorship of the holding company, it's got to be of the bank. One of the big things we're doing in Twin Peaks is to deal with banking groups, insurance groups. You need to deal with the whole group because there's a lot of connectedness, obviously, between them. And I won't deal today with the word SIFIs. We've spoken about them today. In fact, I'm not going to use that word after this. Again, just to remind you, the focus is on financial stability, and that's both macro-prudential stability, financial stability, as well as ensuring that the financial institution is sound. That's what Prudential is about, financial wellness, soundness. Then market conduct. And this we're going to explain because it's more than consumer protection. Okay? Because in the financial sector, consumer protection is not enough. It's how does a financial institution conduct its business. And that's what we're going to spend our time on today. We will at some point come to you because we are preparing a paper on financial inclusion and access, which is an important objective in a developing society like South Africa particularly. And then, of course, there's the whole issue of financial integrity or combating financial crime. Chair, you'll have a bill also coming to you on the FIC amendment bill later this year. And let me make the point. On all of these things, we could say in 2008 we were ahead of the curve. Given that we wanted to have a considered response, we are now behind the curve. So even if you look at the FIC amendment bill, we have, and in all of the financial sector, I talked about the FSEP previously, okay, and we want to come and do a presentation on the FSEP, which is done by the IMF, which is the Financial Sector Assessment Program. Okay, but FSEP chair has to become part of our terminology.
No, I must decide. How long have you been working on this?
No, no, I'm just on this one.
No, no, you are protected.
Okay. So if you look at the FSEP, basically they assess to what extent we meet Basel standards, to what extent we meet insurance standards, we need IOSCO security standards. And in these reviews, which are done every 5 years, they pronounce pronounce on vulnerabilities or weaknesses. Now, some of the weaknesses we're going to address through the Twin Peaks report, but not all of them. Similarly, for money laundering, FATA is the international body, and it did a mutual evaluation 5 years ago, so we queue for those. So all these things get checked soon after. Are you making progress against the weaknesses? So we do need to respond, and this is something else we say to Parliament, that you need to check that you're meeting those standards, because if you don't, it does mean trouble for not just the financial sector, but for trade possibly as well, because it's just how your financial systems are accepted then when you want to make payments or accept payments. So this is the two big micro regulators that we're going to have. Remember that the SARB itself at the bottom is your, as a reserve bank or as a central bank, is doing financial stability, which is a macro objective. But within the SARB, it will also be the micro-prudential authority. And the other one, which the FSB will be transformed into, is the Financial Sector Conduct Authority. But underlying that, we have a whole tribunal and enforcement system, which I think is very important to focus on, Chair. Which, when there are problems, that's how you need to deal with these processes. Omar. So, Chair, then, coming then to the what we want to focus on today. So, as I said, prudential regulation looks at the financial health and soundness of a financial institution, of a bank, of insurance, etc. And they focus on the company directly and indirectly to our customers. So the bank supervision department currently will look at that, the bank, can a bank meet its promises? Can it actually, when the depositor goes to withdraw funds, that they have the funds to give to the customer? So they focus on the bank. But obviously, in that way, they indirectly are benefiting the depositor, because they're making sure the depositor's funds are there. Of course, prudential for pension fund becomes something else. It's about, can your pension fund, but you've got to make sure that you, age 50, you start on your pension fund, that they are, your money is going in the right place, it's been invested, okay, that the pension fund can meet its commitments this year, but that it can also meet it when you retire, it can also meet it till the day before you die, and maybe even on the day you die, okay, and then even after, because there may be transfers to your spouse and so on. Market conduct, on the other hand, prioritizes the customers of financial institutions and evaluates how those institutions interact with their customers and each other. Okay. They must ensure that financial institutions are not abusing their customers. They need to be proactive, and they have to be, on the one hand, take preventative steps to make sure that customers are protected. And then, of course, they can't be all-knowing or God, in a sense. So there are going to be times when people break the rules, and they need to make sure that they are punished. So market conduct is more than consumer protection, because we expect from the financial sector much higher standards. I know I've said this many times to this committee. It's not like selling someone a vacuum cleaner or something. It doesn't work, you go back to game or macro and you say it's not working, or it's within 6 months. If your pension fund is not working now, the problem is you might only find out in 30 years' time that there's a problem. And in fact, in these next 30 years, you're contributing to something that's not even going to give you your money back. It's very important, therefore, that you hold much higher standards and not just look at when the actual problem happens. So in South Africa, we've got to prioritize both prudential and conduct regulation. And let me confess, okay, that if you look at our system, clearly the focus of the regulators is always tends to be on the prudential and too little on market conduct. So it's been sort of neglected. And, you know, I say also that I guess if you sit in a reserve bank, you know, some of them are really good friends of mine, they're ex-bosses of mine, But once you become a central banker, you know, your blood becomes different from the rest of us. And they're not very good at looking after consumers. Okay, so if you ask them to look after consumers, you try and talk to them about bank fees are high, you know, they're not going to really, with the best will in the world, I think that a central bank can't do it, because there's a tension there. The higher, the lower, the more profits they make, the higher the fees, the more profits the bank make, the safer they are. So if you're a bank supervisor, you know, you don't want to bring them down too much. Okay? On the other hand, the market conduct regulator will say the bank fees are too high, okay, and will want to lower it. Okay? And you need the two. And that's why what is decided quite critically is that each of these objectives are equally important. And you need a different regulator from the prudential one. So it's a dedicated regulator for each objective. Now we do this even though when you have, and that's why you had the uniform approach in the UK, because the view was when you have more than one, then you get regulatory arbitrage and column shopping. Now, in spite of that risk, we say you need the two. But you need strong coordination mechanisms between the two. And if you look at the UK and other legislation, that's there in the system. So those are, that's the big decision we're making. Now, even market conduct regulators in South Africa, I would contend, you know, the word I haven't used here is what now even the IMF uses, which is, you know, that regulators must be intrusive, intensive, and effective. So it's not, it's more than, you know, we move in the world from light touch, not just to heavy touch, it's very heavy touch. And you find that even the mindset of our current market conduct, you know, we fight with our colleagues on FSB, we fight with the NCR to say they've not been tough enough. In fact, they've been very soft. And yes, the law doesn't allow them currently to be tough. But you do need a culture change so that they are going to be intrusive and they're going to be curious and they're going to walk. They need to know. And things which are really known knowns can't be unknown unknowns for them, to quote one Donald Rumsfeld, right? So the point is that we do feel quite strongly about the dedicated focus of the two. And, you know, if you have poor prudential and or market conduct practices, they compromise customer and economic outcomes. They hurt confidence and trust. And in fact, they create risk. Because often it's not just the prudential which creates a problem. I suspect in the case of the bank we focused on, there were many market conduct issues. Okay, the investigation will reveal that. But was the lending not reckless? Okay, and if it was, why didn't our regulators, why weren't they wacky enough to see it beforehand? Honorable Ross says it was all over in the newspapers. Now, yes, you know, when you had Northern Rock, you say, but it was in the newspapers. What did you do? When did you know? And when you knew there was a problem, what did you do? And when it was in the newspaper, did you even go and bother to check? Okay? And knowing that if you're a prudential regulator, you still have to say everything's okay and deal with it. Okay, because you can't admit there's a problem, otherwise there'll be a bank run. What I've said to you before, you're like an airline pilot. While the plane's in flight, you can't say, folks, we're having a problem with the engine. You just say, folks, the engine is perfect. Everything's okay. Okay. After you land, post, you have accountability. But that's the point. That's why when any regulator who's going out and making speeches and claiming fire needs to be fired, because a regulator doesn't go and shout fire. A regulator goes and puts out the fire, and after the fire says, folks, there was a fire, but it's all safe. It's, you know, and that is maybe a month later, not even the day, on the day. Okay. So we do need an integrated approach, and I've talked about the separate ones. So just to run through the slides, this is the slide we've shown you how fragmented our system is, okay, move on. And the big focus of Twin Peaks must be coordination. So Council of Financial Regulators, there's a Financial Stability Oversight Committee, there's a Financial Sector Contingency Forum, there's an Interministerial Council. I'm hoping that Parliament is going to make sure these coordinating mechanisms actually work and they're not just talk shops. Because when you have a crisis, inevitably you'll find the coordination was not up to standard. Okay. Now, I'm not going to talk through these because we've done these before. Now you guys can start talking as well. Okay. You know, there's harmonization, but look, these are all promises. I don't want to market it, but that's the intention that we want to get along. So, yeah, to get to this document, which I'm hoping that after this presentation we'll have lots of hits. It will be a really good document, and though the period for comments has closed, we'll still get comments because we still look at comments. And it's very difficult to have a document like this because there aren't too many of these types of documents. I mean, a good example of a market conduct framework, so, and I said that the UK has also got now the prudential regulator is in the Bank of England, or the big prudential, and then the now called Financial Conduct Authority, which is headed by Martin Wheatley. And it's really worth Googling them to see how tough they are, how they're moving on Forex scandals, on LIBOR scandals, on payday lenders, and, you know, Wonga.com has gotten into trouble with them. I mean, you see, there's lots of people in trouble with them. So that's the kind of active approach that you certainly want. But move on, yeah. So do you want to start just talking about the document? Okay, what we're going to do, because we want to just talk through this document, we'll start with the approach and just show you the very real examples that you see. We've got strong views about why they're there. But we want the regulators to be really dealing with these things very actively.
Well, thank you very much. I'd like to just start by saying and apologizing. By no means was I enlightening the teacher to my children. I was just saying I disappeared from disability for a while to look after my children.
No,
the
point I was making was because for people not understand. If you have a baby, and I have two, they toughen you because you're up all night and so on. So there was a metaphorical, wasn't literal. I don't know how KPMG people write their minutes, but I'm making that very clear. And what I meant was, hey, that toughens you up, so you'll be ready for the AFC. I also hope that the aggression that the members show towards me will now be deflected onto the private sector and the prudential of the capitalist system, which is really at the core of all the problems in the world, David, as you might definitely disagree from. How are those being defeated, Linda? Fallout sister?
All market.
Thank you very much. And I think we really welcome this opportunity to be coming at this point as well. The conduct framework is emerging now. It's something which is we're developing, and I think from our perspective, I know the comment has been made that you're tired of 2023, but I think that goes to the heart of the fact that we like to engage while we're actually developing the framework, because that really does help us deliver what we see as a really well thought through not only policy but ultimately law as well, and so these processes are very important to us, and I think as I'm going through today, keep that in mind and thinking what are the I suppose the points coming through to your mind about what you think we should be considering, raising questions around, have we thought about certain types of products, certain types of financial institutions, certain types of problems, and yes, we really do welcome this opportunity, and we'll be talking to you as we develop the framework into the law going forward.
Thank you.
So I think just to highlight up front what it is that some of the elements of what we're trying to achieve from this framework is there's detail here around leveling the playing field and shifting the culture, but really at its heart it's to change the approach to market conduct law within South Africa. Market conduct law and market conduct generally, and that's about changing the culture within the regulators as much as it is about changing the culture within financial institutions. We are moving way beyond a world where we try and predict and identify all the possible problems that a financial institution or a customer could face, or a financial institution could cause and a customer could face, and slap on a rule for each and every problem, because that inherently has its failings. We'll always be behind the curve. We'll always miss something. What that means is the very way in which supervision happens needs to change. And MoMA has already highlighted around the questions around, or the issues about being increasingly proactive, preemptive. But what that means is that the regulator, and I think MoMA used a very good word, is curious. The regulator can't just sit on its laurels waiting for something to happen. And it's also, it's no longer the world where we can wait until annual returns are submitted at the end of the year, sometimes the year after the end of the year, because that's how long it takes for all the audits to happen. And tick the box about, well, we've got this rule, has the financial institution complied with the rule, yes, no, and you might take action later. No, that's way too long. And so what this means is we need to reorientate and say, what is it that the conduct law is trying to establish? We want financial institutions to put their customers on as high a pedestal as they do their shareholders and management. How do we do that? Well, primarily it's going to be to aligning interests. We have to shift the culture to recognize what's good for the customer is ultimately good for business. And already through the TCF initiative, these are the changes which we are in fact starting to see. And it requires ownership through the financial institutions at their executive level. It's no longer just a compliance function. So having said that, yes, the goals are to improve market conduct, leveling the playing field. It shouldn't matter what your financial institution looks like, or whether you're a single person, a small business, a large corporate. To the extent that you're bringing risks to customers, we need to address those risks appropriately and proportionately. A shift of culture of regulating the industry, proactively and intensively focusing on outcomes. What is it that the law is trying to achieve? That the law is trying to achieve the right product, for customers getting the right product to meet their real needs at the right time. So focus on the spirit of the law rather than just compliance. What this ultimately translates into is probably a greater reliance on principles rather than just rules. In terms of the law. So, in other words, a principle is something like your senior management needs to take ownership of a culture of good conduct. That's the principle. The rule is we want to see conduct in your executive meeting at least quarterly. The fact that you've got it headlined in your quarterly meeting is not the same thing as saying that your executive is really taking ownership and integrating a good culture of good conduct through the organization. And that translates across the product distribution as well. But where we do see contraventions, we need stronger interest for enforcement. This is a problem that we're already seeing. Yes, we should. I mean, we're talking about whether it be on the credit side, whether we're talking about problems on the pension fund side. Enforcement does take too long. And so yes, greater emphasis on remedial action, but stronger swifter action. And I think the area which we're increasingly going to be exploring is around consumer redress as well, which is a relatively new area for us in South Africa. And then, and this is a theme, a that we'll talk about quite a lot today as well, is empowering customers, because ultimately it's the customer who knows whether his or her needs are being met, or whether those his or her rights are being violated. And therefore we have to make, or we have to provide for mechanisms by which that customer actually has a voice, develops a voice. So what we're going to be doing today is taking you through the conduct document, and there are a number of chapters and a number of detail, and actually having, as I reread the document, I must say that I think we have done some good work here, but I think also just to make the point that it is just a starting point for us, and we've got a long way to go, and that's part of what we're doing here today. So chapter one then really starts introducing what it is that we're trying to do. It talks about the problem statement.
Yeah, this one,
Chair, just to ask through you, would you prefer that we take questions and comments as we go, or would you like us to proceed? And So chapter one then.
I'm sorry, actually, you know, I think
the teachers out the email. Time is getting mad. The time he gets mad, then I'm in trouble. So the others I can manage. Time he will stop me up. Okay, so henceforth, Paula, please note your editor's note. Linda, can you please note that the meeting started at 10:50, 1 hour, 10 minutes later. Because the chairperson was supposed to be here.
I want criticism of the Justice
Committee, and the entire committee was asking for it. They said, please, we want the old units back. But she knows the reasons for how it was. And they said, why are you being so serious? I said, no, just finish it. Your complaint that I'm nattering on you and making silly jokes. So I stopped it for 2 days. The entire committee was in a petition and said, please, we want the old units back. I'm just committing it myself. I think they're saying good.
Thank you, Jack. So yes, if there are any questions to ask the presentation, please through the chair again, you can hold us at any time. So yes, what is wrong? And I think just to take a step back, we need to understand what market conduct is. And I think that's a good starting point. And what we put forward and how we've been thinking about it is, and I think Moma had made the point, the old consumer protection, the universe, I think it's a lot broader now. We're talking about the financial sector, the consumer protection within the financial sector. So market conduct, this is on page 10, market conduct considers how persons involved in the financial sector conduct themselves and their businesses in relation to clients, customers, and each other, with a focus on fairness and integrity. Now again, just to take a step further back, there's been a history of bad service, and just to highlight a few of the big ticket items, there was the Competition Commission Jarley inquiry a number of years back now. And the Jarley inquiry was set up by the Competition Commission to investigate the retail banking sector, and it looked at the effect of highly concentrated banking sector on pricing charges, ultimately of bank products, banking accounts. But it was an incredibly intensive study that went all the way into how the banks work in relation to each other, how the payment system is operating, how the very nature of the structure leads or inherently leads to poor market outcomes or customer outcomes. And the commission made, or the inquiry made, or the panel made a number of recommendations in that regard of how to remedy. So for example, it spoke about ATM charges, comparability. There was a recommendation around calculators to work out exactly what your bank account is going to be charging, etc. Now, it should be noted that the work that we're doing now is building on much of what was raised initially, or some of the themes that were raised through that banking inquiry. But interestingly, going back and doing an assessment, we've mostly implemented those Jolly recommendations. And there is a review on this on page 45 in the document, in the conduct document. I suppose the question then comes for us, well, you know, we've implemented, is that enough? And I think the very answer is no, it definitely is not enough. And I think the point to be made here is that it raised very important questions, but our understanding of conduct and potential regulatory interventions to get better conduct has really moved on. And so the question now becomes, how can we build on the work that's already been done to develop better banking products that are really meeting the needs of customers? And one of the examples on the Mzansi account. So the Mzansi account, I think it made a substantial inroads into promoting access for financial customers. But the reality as well is that ultimately it just didn't work. And the reason it didn't work was because it wasn't, it had good intentions, but didn't really meet customer needs. And even now, when we see the Mzansi type products, the low-income products, the usage of those products is still minimal. So I think we're going to need to get a lot cleverer in terms of how we sustainably introduce, I mean, we're talking banking products here, but the same way we're talking insurance products, savings products, how do we sustainably introduce financial products in a way which still makes good on for customers. Administration, so some of the other examples, poor pension fund administration, this is where all the retirement money were being put into an account and the administrators were stripping off the interest on that and keeping it for themselves. Crippling early termination penalties that led to the statement of intent, and that spoke to retirement products offered by long-term insurers, and if you wanted to if you wanted to prematurely close that product for whatever reason, you basically got nothing out and led to an agreement between industry and government. That was a number of years back. But even, and I'm highlighting these because really these were the building blocks and we're learning from them, but there's a lot more to be done and we're looking to see what the multilateral response can be.
Maybe just make a point here. So if you see a lot of these, the incentive structure, you know, when you've seen outside that they've acted against bankers' bonuses, the problem is the incentives, even if you're an intermediary, so the uncle who's selling insurance, for example, okay? The point is they were getting, when they would send you a policy, they would get almost all of it right up front, the commission. And that's what one of the problems, the statement of intent, there was a statement of intent dealt with that, to phase in the commission structure, because that meant that once someone sells you a policy, they already got their money. And in fact, what they tried to do, the perverse outcome was what they called churning, to then, you know, after 2 years, to sell you a new policy and telling you it's more modern, it's better. But what they're not telling you is every time they terminated the one and get the new one, they got a new commission.
And we get all the commission.
And we get all the commission. Or let's just take some of your insurance. Every year when they change the amount, that also triggers commission. Okay. It's just scandalous, the facts that you have. It's scandalous, yes. So anyway, so.
Okay. So if we go back going on to the documents, and I just want to highlight a couple of figures.
The middle class also suffers a lot because they don't see. I'm saying God,
the middle class is a means to survive, right? I mean, nobody suffers.
Not the low middle
class.
So I'd like to draw your attention then to table 1.1 in the document, which is on page 11. And what we've done is, at least as a starting point, is to look across the system and look at transactional banking, look at savings, look at credit, and look at insurance, the risk insurance side. So those are the products on the one hand, and then the way in which these products are sold and marketed and distributed on the other. And we highlighted, and this was after extensive engagement and consultation with the respective regulators, with the Ombuds in particular, looking to see what issues were coming out of the media, etc., like the personal finance. And we've highlighted a number of the, these ongoing issues which we're seeing time and time again. I think that is just to make the point as well, that when we've taken the document out and we've really started engaging publicly in this industry and talking about our intention and thinking about what this means, some of the industry response, and they use the word, we're offended. We're offended that you could say these things about us. And so, I think what we can say is that there are a lot of financial institutions who are doing the right thing. And so this by no means are we suggesting that in every single financial institution that's out there are these endemic problems. There are financial institutions doing better than others. But having said that, these problems are real. We didn't make these up. I think that there can be a question around, well, which of these issues are should be prioritized over others, which have bigger impact over others. And that's really the purpose of this discussion as well, and the purpose of the engagement, is to actually put it on the table. And so when we're talking about banking, opaque and complex fee structures, yes, they are opaque and complex. I find it very difficult to work out how much I'm paying for what. The question around incentives and inducements on bank products, unfair debit order practices. These have been crucial in fueling our over-indebtedness problem and well-documented. And so I would encourage you to go through this term and really look at some of the detail and test and say, what other experiences have you had as customers and to be putting forward as well. But really taking out of this, I think it's highlighted that there are thematic problems though. And those are firstly an insufficient focus on customer needs. Secondly, there are many conduct challenges, or many of these problems are actually persistent across the subsectors, whether we're talking banking, whether we're talking insurance, whether we're talking even collective investment schemes. It's hard to compare products. It's hard to compare products in terms of what is the product doing, what is your obligation as the customer, how much is it actually going to cost? How much is it going to cost today? How much will it cost tomorrow? How much is it going to cost next year? How much is it going to cost in total over your 20 years of savings? What are you going to get at the end of it? I would think that we are probably, and given the nature of the work we do, and given the nature of the work that you do, are probably relatively sophisticated in terms of understanding, or at least better informed to understand across products. I'm baffled. Particularly when we're talking about the more complex, the RA type products.
But Kathy, the point is, Chair, no question is too stupid to ask. So most of the products you have layered charging. And you see, as Kathy talks through the examples, you ask what's the fee and they tell you one fee and you think it's low. But it's actually 5-6 different fees of commissions, okay? And so So, and that's why what we did was we went into examples. So if you look at this example, and we'll go through. But we thought we should go through it in detail because this is the kind of thing you an ordinary, say, middle class person, you save for an retirement annuity. Little do you know about the charges. And I would bet that even the person who sells you the RA actually doesn't know the charges. In fact, actually, it's only the actually right at the top who may know all these charges. But let me just go. So in looking at this, what we did was we thought we should spell out some examples, which are real life. Anyone who feels that how could it be so offensive, well, let them first say, is this true? Does it apply to them? Okay. And then we ask lots of questions. We look at on page 13, which is the types of questions that any regulator should be asking about any product. So when Kathy says you can't compare products, and this is what Jali found, he said you can't even compare two bank deposit accounts because one has mortgage, one has a car scheme. It's impossible. Okay. And that's what the market is doing. It's competing on product differentiation, not on prices. But anyway, sorry.
Sure. So looking at the retirement example, and so just to highlight, this example actually came from one of our workshops. So we can very much attest that this is completely how it played out. And in this example, the writer had invested in RA a number of years back in her youth, and decided that she was nearing retirement age or moving towards retirement age, and she wanted to do a reassessment of her various investments. And this product in particular,
and middle class, so we're saying it's
but I want to tell you something. What happened? I think you said this is awesome. No, I really think this is important, right? These people, yes, they knew that many of us are bad. I got caught in this. So I look for you. In court, it's often a community and you have. Now I should bring this. I'm thinking about that point. With this year,
But change, you see, that's why what we've been saying is you want people to save, okay? And that's why we've had all these retirement papers. So this is also drawing on some of our papers, right? Where we say that but people are saving, but then they've been screwed. So the point is that, to put it in unparliamentary language, the point is that there's no incentive to save if all these middle people are getting the money. And there's nothing, there's almost, you know, the customer is getting very little, okay? So you can't go and say to people you must save, it's good to save, if the benefits are going to all these vouchers who are around you and not to the person, okay? And I think that's why our focus is keep customers fair. And in any of these things, you've got to say, what's in the interest of customers? And let me tell you, we find it hard even in government to persuade people, hold on, that problem, because people will say, no, 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 but what about this person, what about, let's say, you know, the people on the ground are black and they are selling insurance, what's going to happen to them? And you say, no, no, it's important you take that into account, but first question is, what's happening to the black person as well who's actually buying the policy, or white person, doesn't matter, but the customer. And that's where you've got to start, because it's not about all the others who are making a commission and getting a cut. Let's start with what's the benefit to the customer. Then you don't lose focus. You can go to the
screen. Sure. So in this example, so she Larasha decided to try and work out why I'm performing badly. So that's in your experience, and now she followed up. And basically what she received was marketing material. So the CIS fund, where it was invested, what it was invested, as well as admin fees. It was all just the marketing response. But it explained nothing. By no means, if you were to read the marketing documentation alongside what has happened to her policy, it's not enough. So when she followed up further, she was in effect told that it's really, really complicated. You can come and talk to us, but you'll need an actuarial experience in order to understand. Mm-hmm. Like, literally, this is what the documentation says. It refers to you will need actuarial experience. It's rubbish. And I think there's two important points that you highlight, and share and reflect in your story as well, that what we have a challenge with... But I think that what this really talks to, though, is there's a legacy, there's a prominent legacy product. So why these stories are relevant is because they were sold 25, however many years ago. And so even though there have been some improvements made to the new generation products, what we're stuck with is a whole generation of people left with legacy products which are still performing and structured in this way.
But let me make a point even there. Anyone who sells you a product, and you've got the whole financial advice price act, okay, which for many people is TikTok compliance. But the point is, when you're selling the product, you know at some point the person will perhaps get married or have a partner, will have children, will, you know, children will be out of school. So if your product is not flexible to deal with all of that, okay, because you can be certain the person's life will change, okay. So even on legacy products, why can't companies say after 5 or 10 years you can review, even if the insistence is to stay in that company, they want to keep your business. But if you even move from one product to another within the stable, you pay the termination charge, you pay the commission for a new policy, you know, it's without end.
And just to highlight, so I mean, what is the impact, the real impact of, or what landed up materializing, because we've got access to actuaries, so we did actually get in touch with our actuaries and we followed up. And I think the interesting point is that it was the fees that were being discharged were not actually the fees which was eating into the policy, it was actually management fees. So the management fees by the investment manager was charging basically a 3% charge per annum, which can have an effect of destroying about between 30 and 50% of value on your pension. Some of the charges, the costs and charges work that's been done on the retirement side, that's coming out of the papers that have been coming out of Treasury as well, look to calculate that over about a 40-year period, that the charges on your retirement account between a 0.5% charge per annum versus, for example, a 2.5% charge per annum. Your 0.5% charge, which is pretty much equivalent to what it is in some jurisdictions, for example, in the UK, would imply 60% greater savings by the end of your savings period. Alternatively, another way of thinking about it is that you'd have to contribute 40% less in order to get the same outcome. That's just how devastating these various fees can be.
But you never see it because it's growth that's foregone. So you'll just see that your pension has risen 5%, but it should have risen 10%. Okay. Half of it is gone. You just see the growth. You don't know how much of the growth is.
Many councillors do not have a lot of money. And I don't know what professors are doing, you know, that federal government has. So, they haven't asked, I mean, you have, you know, the kind of familiar that we have with that, and when you look at the salary.
Yeah.
Actually, it's getting something like 400 and something rand a month. I mean, she's not even getting the equivalent of the.
Does, but Transnet Fund, they have their own legislation. if they fall under the Pensions Fund Act, some of the things that happen would not happen. So one of the reforms we want is to take all pension funds, even those state pension funds, should at least follow the pensions fund, general pension fund. And if there's got to be an exemption, it needs to be explicit and it needs to be done sort of regularly. But I must say, I can't see any reason why they need to be exempted, okay, or they have their own role. So, but look, and this is the thing about this presentation. I'm going to ask Kathy to go faster because we just want you to get a taste of what we're doing. Because let's take retirement. We've got about six papers. I think we've done a presentation to the previous committee. There's been laws that we changed. You saw some of the change that we had last year, for example. There's quite a lot that you could focus on any topic alone. It could take up a few hours. So I just ask members to be a bit patient. Let's just give you the taste of everything.
Sure. All right, so just to take these are just some of the questions that we had asked. I mean, I think they go without saying what information was disclosed. When you requested information, did that ensure really respond to what you was asking and who needs? Should we need to be actuaries? Of course not. How do we hold our institutions more accountable? What needs to be disclosed when and in what format? And questions around portability. And just to take a step back, reminding what we were asking here is a problem statement. So I think we've got into quite a lot of detail about part of that statement is around the products themselves. But there are other elements to it. And just to bring your attention to page 15 of the document, it's figure 1.1. And what it does is it shows you what the current law environment looks like. And what you can see is that, so all those different colors represent different laws. Okay, well, you get a sense of it. I think the point is that there's a plethora and there's gaps. And what that leads to is it means if you wanted to introduce universal and systematic reform, it's very difficult to do so within the current environment because those different laws give different powers in different ways, enforced in different ways, and the like. The second point to be made is around empowerment of customers. And if you go on to figure 1.2, which is on page 17, it's over the page. It's a complicated diagram, but really this is showing what your experience is like for you as a customer. Right from the point where how do you compare products, through to if the product doesn't perform, how do you complain? Who do you complain to within a financial institution? What happens? If it's not dealt with, well then what do you do? Which ombuds do you complain to? And so the story goes. It's complicated,
and
to say the least.
And to make just a point, like your RAs largely will fall under insurance, not under the retirement fund. Administrator. So which when Kathy says which ombud, even which regulator within the FSB,
So in the case of an RA, it's insurance law, pension funds law, probably also the FAS Act. All those have different ombuds, dealt with in different ways, etc. It's taxing on the customer.
So even if you look at ourselves. You're saying within the finance family, even within the FSB, you've got different laws, different silos, okay? So it's not about coordination even with other regulators. That is a problem. But even within, the culture has been that these things are all looked at separately.
So I think what this means, what we're trying to achieve is, if we look at what the problem statement is, what we're looking for is to try to achieve better, more appropriate products that meet the needs of customers, a better law in order to do so, and a more empowered customer to hold financial institutions into account. So moving on then to the next chapter, and again I think what is probably most useful, or very useful, once you go through the example, so I'm just going to go fairly quickly through this slide. I think the point has been made, and we'll make it again, that the financial system is complicated, products are complicated, the system itself is largely integrated and connected, and what that means is that if we find that picture or that diagram, that figure that Momo had shown earlier about a financial loop, within that financial group, you have a full range of financial products being offered to your full range of financial customers. And often those products are offered not individually or separately, but actually bundled. And what that means is that our law needs to deal with the financial product as a system, as a common system. So we need a law which matches how the financial sector is operating. I think the other point to be made is that the impact of financial products that work badly and how they hurt customers affect quality of life. It's a high impact industry, which means we need high impact interventions. So we asked ourselves a number of questions, and it really did come from us as customers. Are bank accounts meeting customer needs? Are households being discouraged from saving by an efficient and unfriendly, customer-unfriendly retirement industry? Why are we as South Africans burdened with such high level of over-indebtedness? Yeah, I think the figures are around half of South Africans are over-indebted. About half are over-indebted,
yeah.
I think. And yes, I think it's around 70% of disposable income is in debt. Is the insurance industry doing enough to make insurance products or provide products that help us manage our risk?
Let's take insurance products, okay? The one example that, in fact, we've been engaging with the insurance industry, and it's been covered quite well. But you just take a simple point. A car is a depreciating asset. If your car, something happens to it, gets written off, they will only pay you what the value is at the time, the market value. Okay. So why annually do they not lower your premium? Why isn't it automatic? Why do you have to phone to say, but my car has less value than last year? Okay. And they have a book they can look at, okay, and they check the value. Okay. And of course, it caused a bit of a stir in the insurance industry. And the problem is, the industry then moved on that score. So we went back, we said, but that was an example. Okay. There's lots of issues. Let's take the claims ratio. So when people are sending you credit insurance, when you take out a loan, okay, the claims ratio is very low. Like they say, don't talk to me, talk to my lawyer. Okay, look at the claims ratios; they're very low. Okay, that tells you there's a problem. People are not claiming, or the claims are being rejected. Okay. So we said to the insurance industry, and there are more bigger issues, because if you look on that page, yes, part of the issue is car manufacturers insist that whilst it's under a car is under warranty, that if you replace the exhaust, it's got to be from that manufacturer, whereas really this is a standard, maybe Bosch or whatever. Okay. And those will lower costs tremendously for consumers. Okay. So that's why you've got to bring, we say, many players on insurance. And again, it's like banking accounts. You can't compare two motor car insurance that you buy from two companies, or even the same company. Because one might cover for hail, one might cover, some may even cover for tire damage, or whatever. Why should it be impossible to compare insuring a motor car? Okay? Most people expect that it should deal with certain things. So, of course, the industry fights with us. They make you sign, all this fine print, okay? And people say you sign. Now, there was a Russian guy. He got an offer for credit with fine print. It was an IT key. So what he did was, he was able to change the terms and conditions, send it back, and basically said, I don't have to pay. We just Google Russian and credit card, you see the story. Okay. he apparently won his case, okay? Because even the company didn't read its own fine print, okay? The way this guy had changed it. But of course, I say to people, you know, you have an app here, you download it. You just go and you accept it. You don't read all that fine print. The law has got to be that what's there must be trumped by legislation. And we talk about later what kids, key information, disclosure, whatever. You know, so if you look at all those practices, there's much more the industry can do if you just took insurance alone. I won't go into field load cover. That's another area that is quite dear to certainly our clients, because you'll find most people who have insurance will have field load insurance before they have even a car insurance or household insurance, etc. But maybe, sorry. So, you know, again, we have an example on page, you know, we won't go into the detail, but we're just giving you an example that the industry is almost geared to say no to claims, okay? That's why you've got to look at the claims ratio. It should be published for every product, because there's no point buying a product when it's a low claims ratio. It probably means they're not paying out or that you don't need that insurance, okay? So those are the kind of, that's the kind of detail that regulators should be looking at.
Yeah. Now, Mo's already spoken around this term comprehensive. So again, I mean, this example is just illustrative. But most, or a lot of policies are described as comprehensive. But comprehensive on one policy is totally different to what comprehensive means on another policy.
Mm-hmm.
What your exclusions are very rarely explicitly explained to you. So what happened in this example is, and sorry, not only exclusions, but terms of cover. So this woman had, she had scratched her car, but because she didn't want to lodge a claim, she thought, oh no, I'll be the risk of the responsibility. But she didn't notify the insurer. Then she had a tail damage sometimes, completely unrelated, not accidents, hail. Her policy was rejected on
the
basis.
Not
that time, no. And the claim was rejected because she hadn't reported on the ding, the scratch from previously. And that was part of those policy terms. The story's got in. But I think you'll start picking up, there are constant themes here. Firstly, how is the product designed in the first place? What are the features of those products? How are the features explained to clients and customers? And when we're talking about disclosure is something we'll hear all the time. But it's not just about, it is about, these are the benefits. The benefits need to be described in a good way. This is what your obligations are. You need to communicate about any accident. You need to be told you must communicate about any accident, even if you don't claim. Then costs. How are costs communicated to you? If you talk, we were looking at the retirement example, the RA example. Costs, often an insurer will say, well, we disclose in costs. Which costs? How are they calculated? What this means is that actually we're needing to standardize the way in which we calculate costs, and those must be reduced at certain times. So for example, point of sale is critical when you're comparing products. So you need to have a standardized way of comparing a product feature and comparing cost at point of sale before you actually sign on the dotted line. Yes, so, I mean, as I say, we're just starting to reflect on the flavor. I want them just to highlight, going back around to the beginning, I think we had, we asked the question, so what is market conduct regulation, and how does it better protect customers? So I'm going right to the first bullet, because this is important. So what we're looking for is a financial sector that conducts itself with integrity in the interest of real customer needs rather than just those of management or shareholders, promotes confidence in the sector by delivering better outcomes for customers and economy. And again, we must keep coming back to that because that really is the intention and the outcome of this all. Over indebtedness, can we go through the example?
I just want to go to the issue of competition. It's in this type of sector, it's amazing that, you know, competition normally brings a bit of normality in terms of price preparation, different products and what you can buy and what you can't buy.
just that customers are not informed with regards to the impact of, say, some loan policy against the initial policy and the cost of that policy. Ultimately, you can only get 30% of your investment back, or 40% over 30 years or 40 years. I mean, you've lost out, but certainly the issue of competition must be preserved, so to say. And why doesn't it reflect in this type of industry? Is that not where the regulation should be very interventionist? You know, where you should strong intervention, because where people have product blinding, so to speak, or where you move on the same lines in terms of business. Why is the competition issue not bringing normality in the sector?
The competition then is on products. So you have a million types of car insurance products, no two of which are the same, rather than on price. So we're saying for the mass market at least, you need to standardize in some way the type of car insurance. I would say there's type A, there's type B, there's type A, B, C, or D. And then you can compare. Okay. At the moment you can't. And even, by the way, if you go into the website which says they'll compare, you'll find all 11 might be owned by one company anyway. Or so the point is that the competition is good, but when you're dealing with a retail market, competition over what? You would hope it's over price and possibly quality, okay? But how do you get that out? But let's come back to it, because it's a worldwide issue. What we are talking about is not a South African issue. But to come back to indebtedness, because I think that is really, now go back to, yeah, it's really a problem. So if you take the same loans, for example, I don't know why or when we started saying, yes, when you buy a car, it used to be 4 years you had to have it paid. Now it's 7 years. Okay. And on top of it, if you look at the ads, they'll say there's a balloon payment at the end. Okay. Those practices are banned in many countries, many advanced economies, capitalist economies. So they'll say you can buy this car, you don't have to pay for 6 months, okay? And in fact your payments for 3 years are like quite low, but your final payment that you make will be for half the price of the car, okay? So it's a huge amount that you have to pay. Now, you want someone to be able to afford credit, okay, that's why, so for me that's reckless lending. So we speak to our friends in the NCR and say, why aren't you moving on this, okay? Need to move on this, okay? Why taking so long to put rags on this? We've distributed to you an article, tell you, payday lenders, you know this nice, Edwards you get, nice old lady, how quickly you can borrow in 10 minutes. That's a crime against humanity almost, because it's a form of slavery. And I'm not joking when I say people are worse off than the time of Charles Dickens, because the people who take payday loans are doing it because they're short of money. Okay? So they borrow. It's very high interest rates. It may be only for 30 days. The point is, after 30 days, and it's linked to your salary. That's why it's called payday. On your payday, you pay. You pay first to them. The point is then, you will be short of cash sooner in the next month. So you borrow again, and you will pay the interest. So you get into a cycle of debt. And we don't in South Africa chair, you were the chair of the Justice Committee, but have insolvency for poor, when there's no benefit to the creditor. So, unlike say in the US, you can walk away from a house and give the keys, and that's the end of your debt. Here, you are imprisoned for life because garnishing orders are put on you. You know, all those tools have been abused, okay? So people are using that knowing you're going to default, and then they will get first claim on your salary. And these people target, just like when you came into Parliament, they target people who are getting a monthly income. That's why you find more than minors, apparently public servants are even more indebted, okay? Because they know there's a certainty of income and then the industry, you see, we're going to have to change the payment system, the rules to NATO, because they know how to go to the system and claim a debit order first. Okay. So all these practices, I mean, we've been saying to our payments authorities at the SARB, you guys are causing a problem because the design of the system is wrong. Okay. You need to have regulations, be tough on payday lenders. In many countries, they can't renew a loan more than twice or thrice. Okay. Look at that article, you'll see. They fine them. Many of them are going bankrupt. You know what? The sooner they go bankrupt, the better. Okay? And the sooner that their loans were classified as reckless and people don't have to pay, it's fine, because those are reckless lenders. Okay? Credit is good for the economy. But if people are using these types of methods, or people link them to your pensions, okay? So if you look at this, you can see the system is almost designed to get you into debt. You know, the point is made that, and this is what we even say to FICA, that to open a deposit account, you can't open it until you've given your FICA papers. But to get a loan, you can get it on the internet. Why can't they be FICA? Okay? You've got to slow this thing down. It's too quick. And people don't realize, when people are desperate, they're not looking at how much they're going to pay in fees or in interest. They just say, we have money for tomorrow, we can pay for the credit card, or we can pay the other debt. So this is a huge societal problem. And I would say, Chair, in Cabinet, took a decision on over-indebtedness in December 2013. I wish you would call us and ask us why we not made enough progress on that. Because I think we really do need to move. We've been talking to the industry. Many of them are prepared to take haircuts on certain loans. Those will bring big relief. Okay. But we've got some issues, I don't know, between ourselves, where people feel, you know, I don't know. I don't know why, I can't understand it, but if people want to take voluntary haircuts for the loans they made, why not? Okay. Does it matter that some of the intermediaries in our system won't make money as a result? Yeah, but I don't know what the issue is, but these are the issues I think we need to meet with other committees, and I think look into how do you bring relief. Because the approach we took was, there are those people now heavily in debt. What can we do to get them out of this hole? And the second issue is, how can you prevent people who aren't there getting into this debt? And that's what I mean, that you change the regulations on 7-year loans, balloon payments, payday lenders, and so on. We need to move much faster than we have. So you can see, as a department, we're frustrated. We want a law in place, and we think regulators can even move, even now, currently, with the laws that they have, by torturing the laws to make sure that, you know, they're more vigorous in their approach and not light touch.
Yeah, I think on the indebtedness side, remember what we're seeing here is just the front end, the customer end. But credit is, it's just one side of the balance sheet to the other side. So it's also to deal with the over-indebtedness part of the problem here, and this is something that, again, we should have learned from fairly long, because it's exactly what happened with the mortgage debt that drove the international crisis overseas, was lending was getting. Not only have you got lending, but rigid lending on the front end, but the way in which it's being funded is on the back end by securitization and whatnot. So there's endlessly more money coming into the system that can carry on pushing out the bad loans.
And so, contrary to what we mustn't believe our own propaganda. When I say we're behind the curve, we may have been ahead on the curve, like, say, on credit regulation. But I promise you, the articles I'm showing you, there are regulators today who are much more intrusive than our regulators. And I think those are the issues. In this area, you can't be complacent. Things are moving. You need to keep on getting tougher, because the players keep on coming out with new ways of getting around the rules. Move on.
So just to finish off.
Yeah, let's finish off.
Okay, so I mean, I think just to maybe to end off on that, we've had a lot of discussion around, you know, what's wrong and what this really has informed what we want our new conduct regulator to look like. And these principles are some of the are informing that process. So around transparency, comprehensive and consistent approach, outcomes based, not just looking at rules and checking boxes, risk-based and proportional, preemptive, a risk-based and proportional saying, let's monitor where the largest risks are coming and put much more focus there to make sure that we deal with and stem the tide where there are abusive practices. Preemptive, we've spoken about, and of course being a credible deterrent in this conduct where there are failings, we need to deal with them thoroughly. So what are we going to do about this all? Yes, there is a new breed of conduct authority, and I think what we've really presented today is that it's a complex problem. It's a challenge problem. It's a big system, financial system, performing a very important role, but we want it to work better. And so what we've put forward is a multiple approach. And what Twin Peaks does is it really lays the basis for this approach. Because what it's doing is it's setting up a dedicated authority that can focus on conduct for the system as a whole. So if we're looking at this diagram here, the structural reform at the very top talks about structural reform of the regulatory agency. The Twin Peaks Act, or the Twin Peaks Bill, the Financial Sector Regulation Bill, as it's more formally known, that sets up this conduct authority with the right mandate, the right powers. But that's not enough. So part of what needs to happen and what's being proposed is a complete overhaul of the sectoral law, the industry-facing law. So currently, you've got the Long-Term Insurance Act, the Banks Act, the Collection and Investment Scheme Controls Act, etc. I think there's 13 of them that deal with conduct in various components. Our proposal is to take all the conduct elements out of those pieces of industry-facing laws, centralize into a much stronger piece of conduct legislation that will lay the basis for the conduct authority to act the way that we see that it needs to act going forward. And just an interesting point, I mean, even on, I make this point because it's exciting, and you might not find it exciting, I find it very exciting. The very objective of the conduct authority is changing from how it is currently in the FSB. So I often get the question, how is this going to be different? Is it just the FSB by another name? No, it's not just the FSB by another name. The objective is different. The objective is not to supervise your law, which is currently the case, basically. So whatever the law says, the FSB needs to go and tick its boxes. The objective is now to ensure the fair outcomes for customers. The function, the responsibility of the authority, the new conduct authority, yes, you've got to supervise and you've got to ensure compliance and all those good things, but you must be more than that. I mean, again, using Mama's word, curious. You've got to be testing the scope of your mandate, of the perimeter of regulation. If there is a new kind of product that's out there that has not yet fallen within the regulatory net, but it looks and it smells like a financial product, and it potentially is causing damage, you must name it, and you must deal with those risks before they escalate. So the very way in which this organization is going to be expected to operate is very, very different. But again, that's all talking about the legal framework and the law and the authority, and even that's not enough, because already we see that there are systemic conduct problems. And we've named a whole list of them today, but there are more. And we've already set up processes to deal with the industry to say, enough of this just talking and going backwards and forwards. We need to identify what really are the critical problems and take steps to deal with those now. Yes, we'll introduce the right laws going forward, but we need to do something now. And we've been setting up those processes as well.
Let me say something.
Sure.
I think that's true.
because our day is also the last 2 days.
Also what?
No, I think you've actually, it's all played out just fine. I think it's right that we focus a lot on what the problem statement is.
Yeah.
Because this really has summarized the solution, and there's a lot more time to talk about that, and there's a lot more detail in that. So I think we've really covered most of what we need to cover today. And just to highlight, I think financial literacy and capability, obviously an important component in terms of empowering consumers, as well as effective dispute resolution. And that talks to both internal complaints mechanisms within financial institutions, as well as the ombuds system, which we've spoken about already. So I'm not even going to then talk through most of these. I think these are just some of, when we're talking about targeted interventions, these are some of the proposals, but again, these need to be much more engaged upon, discuss, have we identified the right set of problems before we can fully commit to how we deal with them. I think just to highlight is that something which you've probably been hearing, or an initiative which you've been hearing about already, and it does lay the framework for a lot, or the basis for a lot of what we've been talking about today, is the FSB Teaching Customers Fairly campaign. And this has been, I think, the Renato, and what Treating Customers Fairly is, it was a marked shift from where the FSB was initially, because where it was is looking at industry by industry, as opposed to a cross-customer approach, outcome-focused. So what we're presenting here is not totally new. There are already steps being done within the FSB to transform itself to deal with some of these challenges. Also, to highlight the retail distribution review, if you want an example of what we're talking about in terms of how this framework actually translates, the retail distribution review, we do have a copy here, but we will make it available to members as well. It talks about the whole distribution chain, and not just for insurers, not just for pension products, but across the board. How do we fix some of those incentive problems across the distribution chain as a whole? And then ombuds, I think again, it's a whole subject in itself. Just to highlight that we recognise, and this is in fact as part of the Twin Peaks framework, so you'll be seeing a lot more of this over coming months, is the need to address the ombuds system as a whole. Again, it's not good enough to just be looking at the industry ombuds. If we want to reform, we need a consolidated approach to ombuds, and that really is a closing piece to talking about a conduct authority, a prudential authority, a systemic authority for the system as a whole.
So the whole issue of when people have complaints, who they go to, like Kathy said, the first one is we check that financial institutions have good complaints mechanisms. You don't want everything to go to an ombud. To the extent that the problem's not solved, the ombuds recognizes the asymmetry of power, that you're a small person, you're fighting about your pension, the firm is big, it can stretch in time, you'll be dead by the time if you do win, but you won't, because the lawyers anyway on that side will be powerful lawyers. So the ombud system is meant to be a quick way to deal with it. But, you know, if an institution has lots of cases with the ombud, it tells you there's a problem with the institution, okay? So, you know, we want this, and we are trying to look at how, even if you have separate activity-based ombuds, but whether you can't have a harmonized system and one offers one way of dealing with it. So people don't have to worry who should be dealing with their complaint. It just goes to one place and there's a mechanism there to figure out how you deal with it. So there's a lot of change you can see in the system.
I think on the question about complaints and disputes is that also to recognize is that part of it is the dispute process and making sure that the customers get through it in the right way and get a fair hearing, as it were. But the other part of that is a lot of information to be learned, both within a financial institution about the complaints that are being made against certain products, and as well as through the ombuds system. And we need to make better use of that information so it feeds back into informing which areas we focus on, be it as a financial institution in terms of improving its culture and its conduct, as well as a system from the regulatory perspective. So again, it's about better information, getting it at the right time, and that helps. I'm using this to illustrate the types of tools that the new type of conduct authority will be using to do its job better and take the preemptive action and the like. And then just to close, the conduct documents, then there are a couple of other chapters. One talks to, and this just closes the loop, financial literacy and capability, and Moma has already indicated that the initiatives being integrated into the conduct authority going forward. And then to highlight, there are a couple of outstanding questions. One deals with the financial markets, to what extent we include financial markets and how within this framework. The second is for the wholesale conduct. So in other words, if you've got a financial institution through another financial institution, what does that mean? The LIBOR example, but there are many others, they reflect that conduct issues are still relevant, conduct principles are still relevant, but the impact is often different. And we need to think carefully about how to absorb those kinds of issues into the framework as well. But, thank you very much.
Yeah, so just to end, so I think what Kathy is referring to is a lot of the examples we've given has been in the retail sector. But when you start dealing with LIBOR, it's more in your wholesale markets and what are the issues. So that's an area also to take up because it has implications for customers and stability. So Chair, just to end, so today we've not tried to focus on financial stability on the Prudential. I think we've just tried to say between our document and the two documents from the FSB on the veto distribution review and the treating customers fairly initiative, I think that those documents are actually have the potential. I mean, the change is going to be revolutionary, or if you want, real radical economic transformation in a sense in the sector. It really will affect the culture. It's about saying the sector needs to go well beyond just serving shareholders. It's got to serve customers first. And I think when I've just given out those articles on the FCA, there's another one they're bringing just on payday lending, just to give you a sense for how tough it has become in other parts. And that I do think that until we put the legislation, yes, our legislative framework is definitely now behind the curve. And even when we have the legislation, you need to change the culture quite radically in all our regulators so that they actually are able to deal with these problems more effectively. And that's not a simple challenge. I mean, once they do it, there'll be much criticized. We look at the criticism on FCA. It made one little mistake last year. And, of course, people wanted a commission of inquiry. The industry was down, you know, hoping to destroy it. But in taking this approach, I have no doubt the market conduct regulator will have many enemies in the industry. The only issue is the enemies all equally hate them, I guess. But it's not a matter of hate. I'm joking when I say that. But I think certainly you need to change the culture, and it's not going to change unless there's a really tough regulator.
All right. Mark, I don't know what other members will say, but I really think your presentation is very simple, and it's really, really good. I must tell you, I was dreading this bill.
Yeah.
The issues are complex, but the way you presented it, I must compliment your team, you know, Momo, Kathy, whoever else, very nicely done. In fact, it strikes me, colleagues, comrades, small comrades and colleagues here, David, I think we must bring this to the caucus. I must bring this to the caucus soon. I think the minister or deputy minister should come and give the caucus as soon as the bill is introduced to Parliament. The other thing, okay, let's leave all this for now. Members, over to you.
I'll come back here. Right, over to the members. If I can just make a
overview, broad overview. We've always spoken about that we should be cautious not to over-regulate and that we should enhance rather the culture. It seems that we're coming with a very strong interventionist approach in terms of a host of legislation coming up. Have you, I mean, we're going to consult with industry, or we have consulted with industry on this for quite a while, I assume. But of course we need to have, in terms of market conduct, some stronger legislation and regulatory reform. But as you said in the beginning, that we should not harm the growth of the economy, we should preserve our institutions, etc. Do we still work on the intent to find the balance between the legislation and the cultural components that's needed to get to the desired outcomes, as you said?
The first question that I have, you know, I think it's strong, it's really good that we are trying to emphasize more on principles rather than on rules. But the only challenge I have is that how do you enforce the principle? How do you enforce a principle? Because, you know, a principle is a principle. To me, it's not easy to enforce it. That's the first question. The other question that I have, which has been something that has been really bothering me a lot, and I know that National Treasury is very, they love this concept of financial inclusion, but sometimes I have a feeling that we claim that we are financially including people when we are, you know, our inclusion is the wrong inclusion. It's not the correct inclusion, and I'll tell you why I say so. Number one, you have the banks that have diversified in ways never seen before, going even to offering products like funeral covers. And to me, they've really squeezed out the mamas that were in the township who were doing this burial class, and they've actually stolen that business from them. And to me, it's not really like the financial inclusion. You are actually including people more as consumers when we are supposed to be including them in terms of meaningful participation, you know, participation as the owner rather than as just the consumer of a particular product. Now, I just want us to just, I just want you to unpack a bit for me. What are the principles that underline this whole concept of financial inclusion? Because it comes up all the time, but I'm not really getting the sense that we actually speaking from the same hymn book. It looks like, you know, I know at some stage I was working with social development, and there was this thing of SASA that, you know, you've been saying we wanted to be including people, but the banks were resisting the biometrics. But the biometrics were actually the real thing to really include the people, you know, because if you are not going to be using biometrics, those people who are not as literate and so forth, and the people who are vulnerable, by the way, from your, you know, from these loan sharks, because they will take the ID. If you have a biometric, you protect those people, because then you need to take their fingerprint, you know, for you to get the money out. And even your social grants recipients are actually so vulnerable at the moment. So I wanted you to check, underscore what is happening with that. And the other thing that I also wanted to know, Che, is that I'm not sure, I mean, maybe Mama will help me here. Do we have a legislation that makes it mandatory for the financial services sector to disclose their operations outside South Africa? The reason why I am saying that is because when we are looking at the market conduct, I don't see us only confining ourselves to just these products, but we need to be looking at the digital economy as a whole. because you may be saying we are regulating the market conduct here, but you might be creating another problem somewhere else. So I'm just trying to figure out how do we put these things together and try and close up this gap. And finally, Chair, I just wanted you to know whether, you know, this I must also commend you. I'm very happy with the way we are now beginning to be citizen or customer focused, because all along it's been more about, you know, this. I know whenever you are talking about these intermediaries, I actually know exactly what is happening with the municipal. In fact, my chair, my VP next to me will tell you, because I submitted a statement to him that I wanted to be read in the House, primarily because of local government, the pension fund industry as a whole, not just councillors. I mean, you have over 79 pension funds in local government, and we are 21 years down the line, and who is benefiting? You have your principal officers, your trustees. I mean, think about that money that gets depleted. The asset managers, each fund must have its own asset managers. You must pay all these different administrators the fees and so forth and so forth. If somebody was to do a study and actually quantify how much that is costing the actual pensioner, it's a lot of money which would be accruing to the member, you know, but simply because of this recommendation, we have that problem. And therefore, Chair, I wanted to check whether we are actually thinking about a parallel process that will be introducing the Twin Peaks legislation, but at the same time trying to harmonize, you know, some of the practices that are there, because there is a lot of fragmentation. And to me, fragmentation is very, very costly from where I am sitting. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair. Indeed, I appreciate it. I also welcome the presentation. You know, I want to talk about specific examples as an ex-banker myself. Indeed,
you...
Yes, I'm an ex-private banker. So I know these issues. I'll give an example. Indeed, the problem where banks normally hide a lot of fees behind very complex fee structures is indeed true. Let me give an example. Once you fight with them and get them to try and reduce commission, what they do is they introduce documentation fees, which generally at times make no sense. And I'll give an example. Sometimes on vehicle finance, we charge people more than 800 rands on documentation fees on documents that were drafted million years ago, where the banks don't even care any cost, we just print them off the system. It still happens. When for example, on personal loans, in the past when consultants could get a commission on personal loans that were selling to the public, when once that was done away with, a documentation fee was introduced on personal loans. And another issue, for example, if you're in the, let's say, private banking, I was in private banking, a relationship manager. When, for example, let's say, Chair, I have a meeting with you, and then I wind and dine you, it's actually out of your own fees. I have to charge you extra money for that. There is a target for that. Yes. If I don't achieve that target, it means then when I meet new clients, I won't be able to wind and dine them. It's as simple as that. But it's kept under wraps. People don't talk about it, they know about it, but every time when you're in a sales meeting, you put under pressure to make sure that you achieve the target so that you can self-fund your programs and your entertainment clients. And the only way you can do that, let me give you an example, even though you might find that you're expected to save, an example, the maximum for a returned item, a returned debit order, say for example you're 170, if a person does that over and over again, a private bank can charge you any amount. They can charge you 400 rand, especially if they're under pressure, they have to achieve the target towards the end of the month. So indeed, the market conduct is a problem in the banking sector as a whole. The other issue, obviously, look at your balloon payments or your residual payments. Even though they work for rich clients like the chair here, in fact, they work better for the rich for rich clients like the chairperson there, but they don't... They don't work well. Yeah, no, you can't be the poorest of the poor. Because then what is that?
The poorest of the poor is the middle class.
how it helps in this instance when you're dealing with your high net worth clients is that, remember, their assets, their cars, are not driven around a lot. They're usually parked, let's say, at the airports because he spends most of his time here. So you'd say during your third year, then your market value and your outstanding balance will more or less even out, so you can change the car without incurring any cost. But if you sell it to Kalumzi Kwakos from Google, it's a problem. He drives around, goes to the Eastern Cape a lot. So come, let's say, the third year, when he wants to trade in the car, then there's no equity. He loses a lot of money. He has to put in 60, 80,000 to get out of the car, or wait until the term expires, and then either raise money to pay that money as a lump sum, or enter into a new agreement where he ends up paying the car over a period of 11 years, or 12 years. So those are challenges that need to be actually looked into and see how we can even empower to make sure that it works for everyone. Thank you very much.
He just reminds me, Nkwankwa is reminding me of, in fact, last week I was at this Africa Day, one of the panelists there, and a point that was raised very sharply from the floor by people from African townships. They really are very concerned about this differentiation when it comes to how much premiums you pay if you live in the township and how much you pay if you live in a suburb. They say you actually pay probably double the premiums if you live in the township or if you live in the suburb. And they feel that, whereas they are, as far as they are concerned, they feel that you have less hijackings in the township. That's the way they weigh the risk. But at the end of the day, it really begins to, you'll not get the poor to subsidize the rich, if you know what I mean. And probably something that you might have to look at as well. Thank you, Obama, for reminding me.
Quick things. Because of time and also the value of the input and the comments made already, mine may sound in it. But firstly, I mean, Mr. Kwanka, I'm serious, actually. Given your experience, we can speak to Alan to alert you. I know you serve on a million committees, right? I understand that, but we would like your expertise and experience to be brought to bear on the processing of this bill. So what I will ask Alan and Estelle and Olivia to do is to just alert you well beforehand when we're looking at this issue. Because we would like you to come, please. Secondly, I think that the point that Makosi just raised, I really am struck by the thing about what is financial inclusion. It's inclusion as consumers. Is it actually inclusion as owners? I mean, you'll see the examples of that, but the point she's making about burial, funeral benefits and all that, it's taking the whole burial sector within the townships out, maybe. It hasn't struck me until she raised it, but I think she's a very good point she's raising. But what exactly do we mean by financial inclusion on whose terms and towards what goes, right? The other thing is that I think, Mr. Ross, we didn't defer about this, right? It's an ideological thing, and you have a right to have your view, I'm very clear. I don't think either National Treasury is being frankly seen as conservative and cautious as it is. That National Treasury is talking about the second more radical phase of the transition. First time I've heard it in a long time. Alone indicates how much its market failure, that it is within the norms, almost one could argue, and the values, and the sort of trajectory of a free market society, that actually use market mechanisms to deal with market failures also. And what is going on is just blatantly wrong. Also, the stress, my example of what I was trying to communicate to Kathy and others before we get lost, is that somebody who is economically literate, like me, I was a senior lecturer in sociology. I speak English my first language, right? It's easier to communicate with these people that come to you. But taken, well, look, I am complicit in it. I didn't even look at this until a year ago. I didn't know what it was. So the point I'm trying to make, please don't refer to it. And then the value subjective, somebody's going to then say, I see the committee chair has got an own action plan. Hey, I have no sympathy for myself. But what I'm trying to say is, if somebody like me, right, born and bred with English, and relatively privileged, I mean, the Indian education system, let me tell you, I don't know what he would say, frankly, was considerably advanced over other education systems. And I think the gap between white and Indian was not that great when I think about it now. Although we had our own issues as Indian activists when I was in high school. But the point I'm trying to make is, so please don't come back to my example, it is misunderstood. But I also think that there are, we can engage outside this meeting as well. That actually, even if you are very, not that you are necessarily, I mean, your party is, but you have almost social democrats, they have complete free marketeer, rights of market center within one party, so on. That's what you are. But what I'm trying to say is, even if you are on the, like, let's say, middle of that spectrum in the DA, you can agree with many of the things. What has been going on is kind of toxic, uncivilized, even by the standards of a normal free market society. Right? And in fact, many of the examples they're referring to are free market societies. I think you're using the British system a lot, aren't you, in this country? I mean, what we're drawing on, that's a very, I mean, it's not Labour Party Day anymore, it's not the 60s. So we can engage on that. But I also think there are some wonderful terms that have been used here. I like Makosi's financial inclusion thing, but it's been included as consumers, not as owners. Now that's like a slogan, right? Obviously it's more complex than that, which you would agree. But there's also wonderful things you say, like you say, which I think is really nice for us to explain these things to other comrades or in different forums. It comes up in a provincial council of the ANC or whatever. But to say, look, if you buy, let's say, a vacuum cleaner, let's say if you buy a kettle, a week later it's not working, you can return it. How do you know your pension is not working? It's a wonderful way of putting it. Mm-hmm. Use another term, Momo, you said, I can't recall, something like this you said, the system is almost designed to make you bankrupt or whatever. How do you want to use?
Yes.
Indebted, that's the word. I think these are wonderful, vivid ways of describing the issues. But I think, Mr. David Ross, I think we all are concerned, right, about, given the, let's put it this way, limited prospects for economic growth, given the need for investment, given the challenges our economy has, given the need for jobs, to not alienate unduly the private sector. That's unnecessary. But if we adopt the approach that Treasury is presenting, actually, it's a way of strengthening the economy and stimulating growth and ensuring fairness at the same time. So it's not against economic growth. Am I right, Momo? It's actually meant to facilitate growth if it's handled properly. Now, the thing is also, colleagues, comrades, I think while, and this is what I'm asking our ANC members to mull over, right? While in terms of principles and values, it's morally very upsetting and so on, we have to accept that this is a free market economy, a mixed economy though it may be. And we have to manage these financial institutions also. So we have to listen to them and see the case they have. So while morally and all we would, what Treasury is saying, we're also having to assist towards trade-offs and so on, right? And phasing some things in. So these are things members need to apply our minds to. We can't be driven solely by moral and emotional issues in a context that, you know, the economy is growing at 2%, you know, and a lot of people, I mean, pick this up all the time, are saying they're not going to invest in so on, given where things are and seem to be going. So we will find the right balance. David, so I think one should know that although you can get outraged by certain things, no one's going to talk about, regrettably, about proletariat, socialization of the economy at this stage, and all that, right? Though I'd love that, but you know, I'm not here in another party yet. So I might add, you don't know that actually, and not eventually, SACP-led the financial sector campaign. And this in Zambia card is partly because we brought out people on the streets. And what struck us, by the way, is SACP. Many, many people out there, I remember I was in Kimberley. Those were not youth and workers alone. It was the middle classes that came and joined us. And in a place like Kimberley, I was really surprised to see so many whites in that march, and colored, so to speak. It wasn't just African convicts there. So, you know, that thing people observed in Gauteng, we had thousands of people on the street. Many of them were actually not your normal constituency of the SACP. So for what it's worth, independently, the party has also taken a decision to revise that campaign. The Central Committee this weekend, and it's taken its own decision together with COSATU, because we are also under pressure for other reasons. But what I'm saying is that, yes, I think this thing must be... The other thing members might want to think about, colleagues, just think about this thing. When do you want us to finish this vote? Because it must go to the NPO, right? Ideally when, realistically. You'll deliver in July, come what day.
Yeah.
So we can have hearings early in August.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, in that case, members, you might want to think about this. We need about 3 or 4 days to visit the customs and excise, right? My suggestion, why it's valuable, let's think about these things, about timing, is you have the whole day during constituency, during committee week. So maybe when the first come here and deal with this and move the customs and excise thing to the first week of the fourth quarter, which is also a committee week. Oh, but then we have the annual report. Okay, let's see what we can do. In other words, I think we should prioritize this book. You think that some things can be done by regulated even now before it's voted. I agree, but until we get... So I think we must prioritize this book. Move it fast. I think that means moving by 6 to 8 weeks our visits to the all this night to do that, but I'm not saying any decision to be taken yet. Let's follow. Right. Having said that, do you want to reply in the 20 minutes? You don't use all of that.
Yeah.
Yeah, whatever you want to use. Okay.
Yeah, just a broad point that I wanted to take up, and in fact, starting with your example, I think the point we've been making, you know, the poor are often too poor to have to be part of the financial sector. That's why we call it financial inclusion, and I'll come to that in a second. Currently, a lot of these abuses are against probably people who are earning salaries, not high salaries, and the upper end of the middle class. You do want a system where people know if they insure their car, they get a proper product. Okay, they know exactly what they're getting. Or the point about taking your example is that actually all of us have been the victims in one way or the other at some point, if not even now, because it's hard to get out of the system. All of us, if you had read that document, you would not. Those mathematicians understand X and Y, not position. Okay, yeah. If you had read that document, in that document, like Kathy says, might be marketing stuff. It might be very fine print. You would not have understood it. Okay, it's designed for you not to understand. Okay, so that's why. So that's why what we're saying is you do need a major and radical change. It is a transformation we're talking about in the financial sector. And Honourable Ross, in fact, these reforms on Twin Peaks in particular actually came from the Conservative government. They implemented Twin Peaks, and in fact, when we go to meetings, we meet them. And that's how I've given those articles, because if you look at them, I would say they are much tougher than any of our regulators, any time, okay? So let's not fool ourselves and say we've been tough. We're actually very soft, okay, on these issues. And the issues are on design. And yes, our issues are, you know, we are, because we Britain was our, was the colonial power here, okay? A lot of our systems are still very similar, okay? Yes, we also look at Australia, we look at other countries, many other countries, but you'll find that some of the financial systems are, not Australia, but say if you look at Brazil and so on, may not be as developed enough when it comes to financial inclusion, and that's what I wanted to come to. But I think what Honourable Ross is also touching on is, let's take something like credit. Just because there's abuses, you're not going to say there mustn't be credit. Okay. That will have a worse outcome. You do want a lot of credit, and I think if you take our credit regulator, their issue was, how can we get more credit to poorer people, which is a good objective. However, you better draw a line, because if you don't, abuses take place. And you shouldn't say it was unintended. You better have your eyes open, okay? And have eyes behind your head as well. So I think the issue here is also not to create a system that's so safe that nothing happens. You are going to have failures. You are going to have problems with how you deal with these issues and so on that we need. So for economic activity, the financial sector is critical. But Chair, the issue you touched on and what happened in 2008 is you can create bubbles. So let's take indebtedness. It could be a bubble, and a bubble bursts, and then you start having lots of problems. And because the system is interconnected, you know, you just need a small, like in the subprime. It wasn't that subprime itself could have caused a crisis. It was just, it was symptomatic of the problem. Once that bubble burst, other bubbles burst, okay? So it was like a domino effect. And that's the problem that we need to deal with. I mean, financial inclusion for us, and I want to differentiate between enterprise development. Financial inclusion is about getting the financial sector to cater to the needs of poor communities, okay? And yes, it's a very hard task because people may not have a lot of money. But if your bank charges are high, people are not going to bank there. If you want to pay your social grants, you want to do it through the banking system. In fact, we say to our social development colleagues, in fact, don't even focus on one bank. In fact, all the banks should take responsibility for dealing with poor communities. And today with technology, you can actually reach out very effectively. You don't need a bricks and mortar building necessarily. But so financial inclusion, like the Zanzi accounts you had, was rolled out a low fee. You could say social grant applicants don't pay bank charges for 5 transactions or withdrawals, etc. Okay. Obviously, one needs to have financial literacy as well because people may not be literate and so on. And similarly with insurance, we say the insurance companies come and they say, you know, only 1 in 3 motor cars have motor car insurance, and can you not make it compulsory? Now that's a good idea, but before we do that, we say, why don't you first look at yourself? Your problem is your products are obviously too expensive. Can you not look at a Zambi type insurance or more affordable insurance for the mass market? If you show us you're making progress, then we can have an engagement. But we're not going to make it compulsory, and then you continue to have high charge products and you behave the way you're behaving currently. Okay, so it's really about making sure that you're getting appropriate financial products for the poor and mass market and the poor. I think the enterprise development, and in fact there's an interesting initiative here in the Western Cape in December last year where the panel beaters and the people say when your geyser burst, they found that the insurance companies were only generating business for 2 or 3 companies. So they don't give work to small panel beaters. Now, whilst we're saying the focus should be on the customer, here was an agreement to say that the work should be spread out. And how do you spread it out? And you certainly want to make sure that you're taking the township economy into account. And you can't just say because they're small, they're useless, they're not up to standards. You get into the warranty issues, certainly. There are complex issues, but I think, and if you look at the financial sector, we have a charter for it. So there's issues about access, about enterprise development. I think the targets don't go far enough, but I think that that's what we need to do. Kathy can talk on the funeral market, but you see the problem is you don't also want people who are selling insurance and then can't honor the product. So. You know, the fact that behind insurance you need capital does become an issue about who can provide the product, but perhaps who can sell the product. But I don't know if you want to say something on funeral insurance. Perhaps you can say. This is the last point that I wanted to make. So I would differentiate between financial inclusion, which is a very important objective, and enterprise development, which is also an important objective. I do think the one takes priority over the other, but that doesn't mean that in doing the one, you're excluding the other objective. I think those are the issues that one needs to look at. Just in terms of some of the practices like on retirement, you know, even with the unions, we've done on the retirement reforms at least 35 meetings where we go to the unions. So there's a workshop at Magaliesburg to understand and fund. So we have to remind them, this is not your money. In fact, a lot of the people who are members of even their retirement funds, aside from the active members, are the people who have retired. You need to think about the members who aren't active contributors. And then they get a company that always sponsors it. It's always in Magaliesburg. And I say, but who's paying for this money? You know, this is your money. In fact, you are the trustee. This is the money of your members. You should be having cheap meetings, not here, out here, and you even give the administrators 10 minutes because they're so kind to you. Hold on, it's your money. They're not being kind to you. If you, in fact, I think we have to ban all sponsorship from pension funds and administrators, okay? So there's a lot of pigs in the trough, and I think that we need to make sure that we're running a relatively clean operation, and there's, you know, we've used the words like transparency and so on. I mean, even something like the big banks, we've tried to persuade on biometrics. I think there are two sides to this story. We've said to even SASA, try and use the financial inclusion we have. Don't try and create your own financial inclusion. Because actually, and by the way, the same thing could happen with bus rapid transport, the tickets they sell. It's what they call closed loop and open loop systems. You do need somewhere a regulator to say these are the biometric standards and they should apply to the industry. Then you don't have to carry too many cards. You then find your one card could in theory go on a BRT. You don't need another card, like if you go on MyCity or you go on bus rapid in Johannesburg. You want one card that wherever you go it would work. Okay, your normal credit card could crash. But those are open loop systems. So that's why we're finding in the whole payment industry it's quite a specialized area and we need to put in much more effort to get the design right. So we are having discussions with SESA and others because I think that there is a greater good in having a more open loop system rather than trying to force people to use this bank or this type of card. Then you in fact create a monopoly with that bank. After a few years they may say they own all the information and you create other risks. You create financial stability risks as well because then everyone goes for their grants on one day. Causes a lot of pressure on the payment system. That's why public servants, we pay teachers on a different day to other public servants. So, you know, there's ways that you can get around these problems.
So I'm just going to go through the list just to make sure we've answered or covered everything. The question around principles versus rules and how do we enforce, it's not easy. And what it does mean is a much more judgment-based approach to enforcement and supervision generally. And there are a number of different features to this. And that's why right at the beginning I said that it's not just about changing the rules or changing the regulatory requirements. It's actually about changing the whole way in which supervision happens and the toolkit. So part of that is a risk-based approach. You can't focus that much attention everywhere. You need to focus your attention on where you see or perceive the big risks. And that in itself requires a highly sophisticated risk matrix, as it were, or metric. And there's very different tools, like upfront testing the executive, how are you making decisions about products within your institution? So, for example, one of the financial institutions has responded to these issues that are all like the TCA framework by setting up an ethics committee. So all new products are now going through an ethics committee to say, and it's tested, how are you, what is this product supposed to do, how is it going to be delivering, and that's within the institution itself. So that what that means is that the regulator is not necessarily just looking at the product at the end of the day and saying, it's asking a question about and assessing those types of mechanisms within the financial institutions. Other types of tools like mystery shopping. So again, it's no longer just ticking the box. It's going and asking the question, mystery shopping, and it's not only about, have you given me about 500 pages of disclosure documents, which I don't understand, all those. it's also about, do I actually understand? And after my 500 pages, and after being
able to find
every, I clearly am not going to understand the thing. But that's a longer way of saying it's going to be a learning process, and it's not going to be easy. Just one thing to add on the financial inclusion, I think the point made about the community and serving the community is also recognizing that that often is as much about the supply side and the product providers. And that in the case of the funeral insurance and the burial society, often is the community itself has provided a very important role. And so what that means is that there's a responsibility on us, and this is taking place as us as regulators and policymakers, that it's not just on the product side, it's also on the provider side. So how does our, what does our law look like? And does our law actually accommodate this wider variety of financial providers? So on the funeral example, we've been very cautious of just slamming down funeral parlors, for example, that are offering funeral products. So we needing to get the balance, this is what Mona was talking about, between making sure customers are protected, but also securing good participation in the sector and a wide reach of participation, because that actually promotes competition and does a whole lot of other good things as well. So the example on the insurance side, on the funeral parlors, is in the new insurance law, which is a bill which is going to be put forward, it explicitly caters for micro-insurance. And it says, and if you're offering a very limited kind of simple product, there'll be significant lower regulatory requirements imposed upon you. And it doesn't matter what your structure is. You could be a cooperative, you could be a one-man shop, but if you can meet these requirements, you're allowed to participate in the market, which is currently not the case. Currently, to be an insurer, you need to be a public company, and that comes with a whole lot of other obligations. So we are learning these lessons ourselves. Then there's the question about disclosure of operations outside South Africa and looking, for example, at the digital economy. I think, well, the short answer is yes, we are needing to look at those issues, and no, we haven't done so enough yet. The question on the digital side is a completely new world for us, and part of even our journey on the conduct side, for example, is how do we start ensuring the right kind of standards that apply to these various distribution mechanisms, again, without completely shutting it down, because then there are inclusion impacts and other things. I think what the starting step, though, is that through the Twin Peaks framework and what the FSR bill does, is it doesn't distinguish between financial institutions and others. If you are participating in the financial system, you need to be regulated for the risks that you're bringing into the system, and that flexibility for the first time is being granted to the regulators as well, which I think is an enormous step forward. Then on the question of high fees behind complex fee structures, yes, well noted. There are a number of components to this. I think firstly, it goes to the competition question which was raised earlier. And to get the competition right, you're really needing comparable product features on the one hand and fees disclosed in the right way and in a comparable way on the other. And there are a number of initiatives underway to try and ensure that that gets done better. The example of the debit order penalties really, I think, highlights the need for principles on the one hand, not just a rule. This is the kind of thing where there are prolific, or these types of practices are prevalent across the sector. And if we try to stand on a rule for each and every one, we're not going to do. I think just on the principle rules issue, though, it's not principle substituting rules. I think that there's a very important balance that needs to take place. We need the entrenching principles that are supported by the rules where necessary. I think it also, that debit order penalties also emphasizes or highlights the role for EXCO, for the executive or senior management within a financial institution. That if these kinds of decisions are not coming from the top, you're never going to have the right products for customers.
In fact, I mean, that was an issue that the Jali committee had actually recommended. So there's been some movement on it. The question is the movement enough?
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's where you get back the rule versus the principle and the culture and law of a financial institution and the organization shifting. Then the question around paying double pre or paying significantly more premium in townships relative to suburbs, is that a fair reflection on risk? I think the question might be here is around fairness and pricing methodology. So it's not talking about dictating pricing and saying, are you really treating your customers fairly in the way that you're assessing risk and the like.
But I think on that one also, the subsidy issues, so who you ring fencing. So certainly in the early 90s, there was what was called a redlining problem, and people couldn't get mortgages in the township. So the sector took an extreme position by not providing mortgages. Now what they're doing perhaps is they're putting a risk premium on cars. These are the issues that I think we have to engage with very actively with the sector, because it is about nation building. If you want stability in the townships, you can't penalize people for living there. But on the other end, they're taking the risk. So perhaps there's a role for government as well. But I'm saying one needs to actually engage on these issues.
All right. So then just a final comment on, and there has been much discussion on this already, about the level of intervention and whether it's appropriate or not. I think what we're looking for is not more rules and more law. It's better law. And it's law that it's more flexible and accommodating if you as a financial institution are actually serving your customers well and working well, but it's much harder on you if you're not. And currently the law is too blunt. It doesn't facilitate that, and I think that's bad for industry and it's bad for customers. Mm-hmm. So thank you.
To end, thank you. I think to end then, we're going to leave you with the two other FSB documents. You've got the market conduct document, but we wanted to just draw attention because, in a way, with all the other work we do, this thing has been almost relegated in prominence, and I think that's why we went through the document, because there's a lot there. It's also written, as you saw with the examples, to show people how the problems they think they have is actually a general problem, and the question is, how do we deal with those problems? So we really like engagement, and I would say, Chair, the next time we go to I've asked the Financial Sector Coalition also to go there to make a presentation. So wherever I think members go, if there are areas or communities or sectors that they think we should talk to about market conduct, I think we'd be very happy to go there, because I think spreading the word is the first step before you can deal with the problem. So thank you, Chair.
Okay, thank you.
Starting 10 o'clock tomorrow, by the way, David will be impressed. Last night on the plane, I was reading a CDE document, Zaha, on the middle classes in Kenya, Brazil, India, and South Africa. I got the summary, the two major projects. What I will do is, I'll get Harry just finished. You can fill out the memo. It's only 8 pages. You can. My point of interview is to understand the middle classes in Gauteng and their voting habits. It's an interesting thing. Who is responsible for them being the beneficiaries since 1994 and how they voted and so on. So somebody told me to look at this thing. It's interesting, you can look at it. It's about 8 pages.